Our scripture this morning is taken from John chapter 8, beginning with verse 2. At dawn he appeared again in the temple courts, where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now what do you say?" They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "If any one of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone at her." Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left and the woman still standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go and leave your life of sin."
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound, now flowing down, hands and feet that were nailed to the tree. His grace flows down, His grace covers all my sin.
And covers me, and covers me.
Covers me,
and covers me.
I want to share a little true story with you this morning. Back when I was a boy of about 9 or 10 years old, my family and I went to visit my cousins, who all also happened to be boys of about 9 or 10 years old. And because our parents were not the kind to let us sit around and watch television all day, we were wandering around the neighborhood looking for something to do. And we came across a work site where a new house was being built. And much to our delight, we discovered that it was littered with dirt clods that were just the right size for throwing. Now, if you've ever been a 9 or 10 year old boy, then you can probably imagine what happened next. It wasn't long before we were bragging to each other about how well we could throw, and that led pretty quickly to taunting each other about everybody else's perceived throwing weaknesses. And soon we had chosen up sides for a full-on dirt clod war in which we hid behind piles of construction debris and just hurled dirt clods at one another. And we were actually having a pretty good time, laughing and taunting and throwing our dirt clods, when quite by accident, I'm sure, one of my cousins threw a dirt clod that was less dirt and more rock, and that hit me right smack dab in the middle of the forehead. Now, I'm happy to report that it didn't really hurt all that badly, just a little sting that made me put my hand to my head. But when I took my hand away, I couldn't help but notice that it was covered with blood. So naturally, I did what just about any 9-year-old, 10-year-old boy would do. I started screaming like I was being chopped to bits by an axe-wielding maniac, and then I bolted for home. Now, my mother, as you can imagine, was, let's just say, somewhat distressed when I ran in the door, yelling and bleeding profusely. But it wasn't long before she got me calmed down and cleaned up and carted off to the emergency room, where, if I recall, it really only took 2 or 3 stitches to close up the wound. And right about here, of course, is where you might be asking yourself, why, Pastor, are you telling us these things? After all, I'm reasonably certain that it's probably been a while since most of us were involved in a full-on dirt clod war. And for the most part, I doubt we spend a whole lot of time hurling rocks at one another. Or do we? Oh, sure, I doubt that we pick up literal rocks and throw them at one another's heads. But is it possible that we do pick up stones of criticism and condemnation, along with rocks of blame and judgment, and maybe, without even realizing it, throw them at our families and co-workers, at our brothers and sisters in Christ, and even at people who we don't really know, but for whom Jesus gave his life? Well, that's the question I'd like us to consider this morning as we continue our journey of stones, as we're calling it, and as we look at a story in which a whole lot of people end up finding themselves caught between a rock and a hard place. Now, before we start looking at the story itself, I do feel a need to point out that this particular text stands out a bit from other passages in the New Testament. If you happen to have a study Bible or a Bible with pretty decent footnotes, then you might be able to see that many of the earliest and best copies of the Gospels don't include this story at all. And those who do have it don't always put it in this spot. Some put it elsewhere in John's gospel, and others put it over in Luke's gospel. And when you add in the fact that many early teachers of the church never mention this story, there are scholars who suggest that it doesn't belong in the Bible at all. On the other hand, there are a few early teachers who do mention the story. And one of them, St. Augustine, who was a pretty significant figure, he suggested that it was removed because, and I quote, "some were of slight faith and to avoid scandal," unquote. In other words, it could be that some of the early Christians who wrote out the copies of the Gospels decided that this story was a little bit too dangerous, because it presented such a radical view of God's grace, and so they left it out. Now, I don't know if that's what happened. And in the end, I think that each of us has to decide for ourselves whether the Jesus that we meet here is consistent with the Jesus that we read about in the rest of the Bible. And for my part, I wouldn't preach on this story if I didn't think he was. And so with that having been said, I'll invite you to consider with me John chapter 8. By the time our story begins, Jesus has been in Jerusalem for a while. He's been teaching in the temple, creating controversy about who he really is, and coming into conflict with the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. And as a result, it's really not a big surprise that the religious leaders start looking for ways that they can damage his reputation. And so as we pick up at the beginning of the chapter, we read, "The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, 'Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now what do you say?'" Of course, right out of the gate, I think we need to notice that even if the Bible didn't tell us that the real motive behind this question was to trap Jesus, which it does tell us that if you were listening closely, it would still be fairly obvious, I think, that the religious leaders weren't all that interested in holiness or justice or defending God's law. If they were, they would have dragged this woman off to the priests and not to Jesus, since he didn't have any authority to enforce a particular judgment. And what's more, they would have brought not only the woman, but also the man who had been caught in the act of adultery. After all, the two main passages in the Old Testament law that talk about the punishment for this particular sin make it clear that both the adulteress and the adulterer are to be put to death. And so we need to understand that for the religious leaders, at least, this woman and her sin are nothing more than tools in their hands. What they really care about is finding a way to trash Jesus in the public eye. And as far as they're concerned, they've got him caught between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, if Jesus rejects their suggestion that this woman should be stoned, well, then clearly he doesn't care about God's law, and nobody is going to follow a prophet like that. But on the other hand, if Jesus affirms their judgment and agrees that this woman should be stoned, then not only will people see that he's not the friend of sinners that everybody thinks he is, but in addition, they can go out and say that he's an enemy of the state. Because in that place and time, only the Romans had the authority to put someone to death. The Pharisees and the teachers of the law had been trying for quite some time to trap Jesus. And somehow he had always found a way to wiggle free, but not this time. This time, they thought, they had him, and so they were just waiting to see what Jesus would do next. Before we move on, however, and take a look at how Jesus responds to their question, I think it might be worth pausing so that we can ask ourselves, what was it that led these Pharisees to take up stones in the first place? I mean, is it simply that they are so jealous of Jesus and his popularity that they are willing to destroy another human being just to take him down a notch? Are they so hungry for power that they will say and do just about anything to eliminate a potential rival? Or could it be a little bit more complicated than that? Could it be they're afraid that if they don't stand up for the values they hold dear, then nobody else will? Could it be that somewhere deep down they really do care about sin and holiness and honoring God, and they don't want to see anybody get in the way of defending what they think is right? Well, for better or worse, I'm not sure that the Bible gives us enough information to know with certainty what's going on in the hearts of those religious leaders. But if we're lucky, it might give us enough information to at least examine our own hearts. Because if we're honest, don't we live in a culture that's pretty quick to take up stones? After all, a lot of politicians seem more than willing to say and do just about anything in order to eliminate a potential rival. And a lot of preachers seem more than willing to call down judgment on the gays or the liberals, the Muslims or the immigrants or whatever group of sinners we happen to have in the crosshairs this month. And maybe even we ourselves, when we're jealous or afraid, when we're threatened or angry, aren't we sometimes tempted to see not people made in the image of God, but instead to see targets for stones of judgment and condemnation that sometimes we're just a little bit too eager to throw? Maybe we too are guilty sometimes of standing around with rocks in our hands and just waiting to see what Jesus will do next. And what Jesus does, of course, is somewhat unexpected. Looking back at John chapter 8, the Bible tells us, but Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. And when they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let any one of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." Now, if you've studied this passage before, if you've listened to other sermons that are based on it, you might be aware that from very early on, different preachers and teachers have speculated about what Jesus was writing when he bent down and started scribbling in the dust. And probably the most popular suggestion has been the idea that he was writing out the sins of each and every accuser, making it clear that he knew exactly what they were guilty of. He knew the lies that they told and the desires that got out of control. He knew the pride that made them look down at others and the idols that competed with God for their time and attention. He even knew the lack of love that made them think it was okay to treat this woman not as a person, but as a thing. Just a tool to be used in their crazy scheme. Just a sinner to be condemned and cast away. Of course, the challenging thing is that Jesus knows all those things about us too. He knows that just like those religious leaders, we're as deserving of condemnation as any of the people we'd like to throw stones at. But it is worth noting that the Bible doesn't tell us what Jesus wrote. But then again, isn't what he said enough? If any of you is without sin, let him be the first to cast a stone. Suddenly, it's the religious leaders and maybe even we ourselves who get caught between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, we've got all these powerful emotions, jealousy and anger, fear and righteous indignation. We've got a deep conviction that something needs to be done about this woman, about Jesus, maybe about both. But on the other hand, we get confronted by a profound truth. There's only one who has the right to pass judgment, because only one is without sin. It might be tempting to think that we can aim stones at others because we go to the right church or believe the right doctrine or we avoid the right socially unpopular sins, but it's just not true. Instead, we need to recall what Jesus told us over in the Sermon on the Mount. Judge not, that you be not judged. For with the judgment you pronounce, you will be judged, and with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. It appears, at least, that that message started to penetrate the hearts of those religious leaders. And so the Bible says they dropped their stones. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left, with the woman still standing there. I can't help but wonder what must have been running through her mind in those awkward moments after the crowd was gone. Oh, sure, it appeared that the imminent threat of a terrible death had been taken away, but there was still the humiliation of having her most intimate failures put on display. And there was still the pain of broken vows that she and her husband would have to figure out. And at that moment, at least, there was still the question of what Jesus would do next. It's true, he had saved her life. But now, would he save her soul? Would he offer her a shred of dignity or a glimmer of kindness? Would he give her some foundation to rebuild her life on so that she could look to the future with hope rather than despair? And that's why it is a moment of pure grace when the Bible says that Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life of sin." Now, I can't tell you how important it is for us not to misunderstand what's going on in that exchange. Some people look at this story and they see the compassion of Jesus and the way that he doesn't make this woman jump through hoops to earn forgiveness, and they walk away with the impression that sin doesn't matter all that much. They imagine that Jesus is kind of like an overly permissive grandparent who sees all the junk we get into and the mess that we make of our lives and says, "Don't worry, it's not a big deal." But it is a big deal. In fact, sin is such a big deal that Jesus had to die in order to free us from it. He was willing to be whipped and beaten and crucified. He allowed himself to be caught between a rock and a hard place, between our sin on the one side and the punishment we deserved on the other, in order to make sure that not even our sin would ultimately be able to separate us from the love of God. And because forgiveness comes at so high a price, we must not forget that while the grace of God is free, it's never cheap. One rather famous theologian puts it like this: cheap grace, he says, is the deadly enemy of the church. What we need today is costly grace. Cheap grace is the grace that we bestow on ourselves. Grace without discipleship, grace without the cross, grace without Jesus Christ living and incarnate. But costly grace is the treasure hidden in a field for the sake of which a man will gladly go and sell all that he has. It's the pearl of great price for which a merchant will sell all his goods. Such grace is costly because it calls us to follow, but it's grace because it calls us to follow Jesus. It's costly because it calls us to lay down our lives, but it's grace because it gives us the only true life. It's costly because it condemns sin, but it's grace because it justifies the sinner. But above all, it is costly because it cost God the life of his Son. And what has cost God much cannot be cheap for us. Jesus, you see, forgives this woman, but he also tells her, "Go now and sin no more." You could say that he catches her between a rock and a hard place. Between the sin that almost destroyed her on the one side and the challenge of new life on the other. And make no mistake, new life is a challenge. It means taking up our cross and following Jesus. It means dying to sin so we can be raised to life. It means letting go of our stones, regardless of whether they're stones of judgment, like they were for the Pharisees, or stones of sin, like they were for this woman. When you came into the sanctuary today, hopefully you were given a stone. And like I've been saying to those of you that have been here in the last couple weeks, there's no way for me to know what your stone is or what it needs to be. Maybe, like the religious leaders, you're carrying around some stones of judgment. There could be people in your life, maybe in your class or in your family or in your workplace. They could be close to you, or they could be far away, like those people whose beliefs or behaviors or politics you don't approve of. And the bottom line is that you've gotten so accustomed to judging them by the sins they commit and the labels they wear that you can hardly see them as people anymore. Instead, when you look at them, you see a target, rather than a child of God for whom Jesus gave his life. But Jesus offers you a chance today to let go of your pride and your perceived self-righteousness, which only get in the way of your relationship with God to begin with. And so you need to put down your stone. Or maybe, like the woman in our story, you're carrying around stones of sin. They might be obvious sins, the kind that get you hauled in front of a crowd to face taunts and accusations. But then again, and probably more likely, they could be hidden sins, the kind that creep into your life slowly and are known only to you and to God. But Jesus, you see, offers to take those sins and nail them to his cross so that you can walk away free to sin no more. And so you need to put down your stone. It is interesting, I think, that we don't really know how this story ends. Did the Pharisees and teachers of the law have a change of heart? Did they go away from this encounter a little more inclined to recognize their own sin and a little less inclined to throw stones at the sins of others? Or did they just get angry and start looking again for a chance to trap Jesus? And what about this woman? Was she truly changed? And did she find the grace that gave her power to live life anew? Or did she find out that new life is hard sometimes? And did she get tired and discouraged and go back to old habits? The Bible does not say. And maybe the Bible doesn't say, because that's not what matters. Maybe what really matters is how our story ends. What will we do with our stones? Will we hold on to them because we're so accustomed to them, or because they feel so good in our hands? Or will we put down our stones at the foot of the cross of Jesus? That is our invitation. And this is our journey of stones. Jesus invites you to come and to take the journey with him.
Sadness from wherever you've been. Come brokenhearted, let rescue begin. Come find your mercy, oh sinner, come kneel. Earth has no sorrow that heaven can't heal. Earth has no sorrow that heaven can't heal. So lay down your burdens, lay down your shame. come as you are. There's hope for the hopeless and all those who've strayed. Come sit at the table, come taste the grace. There's rest for the weary, rest that endures. Earth has no sorrow that heaven can't cure. So lay down your
our early service today, that I've been very grateful for, well, just the opportunity to go through this little message series so far. It's been very meaningful to me, and I'm grateful for those of you that have told me that it's been meaningful to you too. I find myself keenly aware that it's meaningful, but still awfully easy to walk down the front, follow the parade, drop your stone at the cross, and that's good. And I hope that maybe it at least invites us to think about what it means for Jesus Christ to take our burdens away. The real challenge is to walk out of this sanctuary and to actually live like we've been freed from those stones that otherwise would weigh us down. I had a chance to meet with one of our church members this week, and we were just talking about ministry here and things that go on at Calvary. And as I told her, I mean, I'm so grateful for the affirmation you all give, for the things that you all do. But there's nothing that means more to me than when we actually live out what we represent symbolically here today. When we go out and live like free people, when we drop our stones and help others understand that they can do the same. We're invited to sing a hymn of commitment, "Wherever He Leads, I'll Go." And this is one of those hymns that it is so easy to just stand and sing and feel good about singing. But boy, it is a hard hymn to mean. Will I follow Jesus wherever He leads? Even when He leads me to forgive people who I'd prefer not to forgive, and to serve people who I don't really care for all that much, and to actually confess to Him how desperately I need Him. If there's some way that you need Jesus to lead you today, I hope that God would open your heart just enough for that to happen. And of course, you don't need me for that to take place. I mean, you can sit where you are, you can kneel at the altar, you can go home and talk about it with Jesus later on. But the only reason I stand down here, other than looking silly, is so that if you need somebody to pray with you about those ways that God is at work in your heart, I can do that, and I'd be happy to.